So do you want to break down what is meant by personalized rate of return?
Boy, this is going to be exciting in audio form. So,
welcome to the Mostly Money, Mostly Canadian podcast with your host, Preet Banerjee.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Preet, your host, and today we'll be talking to one of Canada's foremost financial services expert, Dan Hallett, about a wide range of topics relevant to retail investors, such as the cost of advice, the new reports investors will be receiving about the cost and performance of their accounts, the robo-advisor business model, and the blurred lines between passive and active portfolio management. But before we get to Dan, most listeners know that I give a shout out to everyone who leaves a comment on iTunes. And leaving a star rating is very much appreciated. So if you find value in listening to the show, head on over to iTunes and leave a rating. If you want to take the time to leave a comment too, please know that I do read them all. I have a few comments to catch up on as I've been an absentee podcaster, as you know, happens from time to time. But I'll share one now. And at the end of this podcast, I'll catch up on a few more. There's a lot, so I don't want to subject Dan to listening to him while he's here. But the one that I want to highlight is from Jessica Morehouse, a fellow podcaster who has a great personal finance podcast titled The Mo Money Podcast. And if you're starving for content, because I don't podcast very often anymore, Jessica is an absolute machine, pumping out episodes pretty much every week and sometimes more than one a week. That being said, here is her comment. And I quote, "Preset is my favorite money guy." Yes, Preset is just the best. I'm just so glad he got back to podcasting after his hiatus. So I think clearly this is a case of autocorrect. At least that I'm going to give Jessica the benefit of the doubt. In any case, check out her podcast, the Mo Money Podcast, which I have been a guest on, and perhaps I can get her as a guest on this podcast in the future. Now, as I said, I'll leave some more shout-outs at the end of the show, but without further ado, let's introduce my very patient guest today, Dan Hallett. Dan is a vice president and principal with Highview Financial Group. He is responsible for manager research, portfolio construction, and investment program design. With more than 20 years of industry experience, Dan is a well-known investment industry expert, regularly featured in print, on TV, radio, and online. And he's contributed research to Morningstar Canada, The Globe and Mail, Canadian Money Saver Magazine, Advisor's Edge Magazine, and Advisor's Edge Report. And I'm probably just scratching the surface of all the different publications that Dan has contributed to. And he joins me today in Toronto. Dan, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, before we get started, let's talk a little bit about who you are. Now, you've been a guest on this podcast before. So for people who want to go to the backstory to back to high school, and I think you were like a weightlifter and all this stuff. I think we talked about that one time on a podcast. So that's all there. But for new listeners, let's give them a quick refresh. Tell me a little bit about Highview Financial Group.
Well, Highview is an investment counseling firm, and it was really built on the idea that we wanted to take all the practices, disciplines, and importantly, the governance that happens in a traditional single family office. So that's where a team is dedicated to running the wealth of one family, and bring that to a commercial operation serving multiple families and foundations. And so it might, you know, just to touch on a couple things to make sure that we're independent, right? So if we developed our own expertise in trying to pick stocks and bonds, we couldn't figure out or we wouldn't be unbiased in deciding whether we're doing a good job or if we need to be fired, that sort of thing. So there are a number of principles along those lines that are very client-centric that we wanted to bring to a more commercial operation.
And whereabouts is Highview located?
Based in Oakville. Mm-hmm. And we have a North York office, and you're looking at the Windsor office.
Okay. So the Windsor office is mobile.
It is, but we're hoping to have more of a presence there over the next year or so.
Right. Excellent. Okay. So over the last couple of months and maybe last year or two, every now and then we'll have email exchanges and you'll listen to the podcast or we'll comment on each other's articles that we're featured in. And so there's a couple of issues that come up time and time again. And one of the ones that where you had emailed me was about the robo-advisor business model in general. So maybe we could just start with getting your general thoughts on the whole robo-advisor genesis that we've experienced in the last 2 years. Just, you know, what are your comments in general about robo-advisors?
Oh boy, big topic. You know, I think what they're doing is kind of cool. I like the idea of a streamlined, really tech-driven solution for people. It's obviously not going to be a fit for everybody. But yeah, a lot of things start going through my mind as when I really just sit and think about it. And some of it is really on the business model side, like how are they going to do this? You know, someone who's been on the client side, I mean, not primarily client, but either part-time or full-time for basically my entire career, knowing what has to be done both with the client and in the background, I start to think, well, how the heck are they doing that? Like, I know you can use technology for a lot of stuff, but then it's to the standard that regulators adhere to or require you to adhere to. So things like profiling your client, which is, you know, has sort of come up lately, but profiling them from an investment perspective, but also from a anti-terrorism, anti-money laundering perspective,
right,
which is a completely other set of requirements, separate from the sort of typical know your client or KYC type of stuff.
Yeah. And just to speak to that, when back when I was a broker, I remember the AML training, anti-money laundering training, and there was a requirement where, you know, anyone you had a responsibility to make sure that they weren't on any of these terrorist watch lists or any lists where they're suspicious activity. And it was, the onus was on the advisor to do those checks and do Google searches and whatnot. And I can tell you, there's a lot of people who probably didn't do those things, but they should have. And I can see how that could be a challenge, because I'm sure there's technology which would say, well, here's their name and here's maybe their SIN number and do some kind of automated check. But again, with the training that I had was you had to go a little bit deeper than that, because if someone is, you know, unknown to you, then there's a higher required or higher expectation that you would vet them better. And that would go beyond just looking at that list. You have to look at possible different names, sometimes reference. Again, if someone was completely walking into your office out of the blue, that's almost the first red flag, right?
So. Well, and sometimes we deal with clients at a distance.
Right.
And if you're just giving pure advice, it's less of an issue, although today it isn't, because the AML, the anti-money laundering requirements are the same, whether you're just giving advice or actually handling the money. But I'm pretty sure that if we have a client that's in a different province where we're not actually there in person, we have to find somebody on the ground, like a lawyer or something along those lines, who will attest to the fact that, yeah, this is this person's driver's license. You know, it's real. And because they send you a scan, they send, you know, all we need is a copy, but we need to see it.
Right.
So I'd be curious to, if I ever could, get on the inside a little bit and really dig into some of those details, which a lot of people wouldn't care about, but it is really relevant with respect to the sustainability of that business model.
Right.
I suspect there's a way to do it, because there'd be similar regulations in the US, and you've got, I don't know, Betterment, Vanguard, Wealthfront that are all running billions of dollars on this model. I know some of the rules are a little different, but the anti-money laundering would be similar. I'm guessing that there's a way to do it. I'm just not sure exactly what they do.
Okay, so I kind of cut you off with respect to some of the questions or comments that you had with anti-money laundering.
I warned you I was going to ramble.
Oh no, that's fine. That's great. So what else?
Part of it is one of the things that would bubble up for me is just the what they do on the investment side. And that touches on a couple things. You know, I've seen reference in articles to things like when algorithm picks your portfolio. I'm not sure that's entirely true. I think what happens is people pick the products that they're going to build portfolios with.
Right.
And then in an automated fashion, they're constructed for you based on your profile.
Right. So it's kind of like, it's a very limited opportunity set, which is generally made up of exchange-traded funds.
Yeah.
And the overall product shelf is relatively narrow. It's not like an algorithm is constantly saying, here's the screen that I'm applying all the time and doing a check. It's someone has decided, no, instead of looking at thousands of different options, here's 10 that you can look at. And that's all it's ever going to be. And maybe that shelf changes over time. But one of the things that we chatted about was passive versus active.
Yes.
And especially when it comes to the robo-advisor model. So there's this obviously a growing wave of people who are interested in passive portfolio management. And some people would argue that younger millennial investors who are more about apparently transparency than others. I don't know if that's necessarily true. But they all go to online sources of advice, and a lot of online somewhat independent commentators all tend to lean towards, you know, ETFs, passive management. The blogs are riddled with people who are pro ETF and indexing.
Yeah.
And so a lot of them will say, okay, that is what I want. And so a robo-advisor, a lot of them are kind of positioned as, yeah, you know, it's Nobel laureate winning theories of passive management and whatnot. But you suggest that maybe it's not entirely passive management. So what do you mean by that?
Yeah, I'll do more than suggest. It isn't in most cases.
Right.
I haven't seen what every robo is doing. Passive, you can have a passive product that's really passive. So there's different levels here. You can look at the product in isolation and say, you know, is that a pure passive product? And then there is the way that you behave with it, what you do with it.
Mm-hmm.
So you could be using the purest of indexing products, whether it's a fund or ETF, but let's stick with ETFs because that's what all the robos are doing. And if you are changing things frequently, if you are adding a tilt here, tilt there, in other words, adding exposure to a particular sector or part of the world, a different region or country, well, now you've become the active manager, even if you're using quote unquote passive products.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is this big gray area. Some people call it smart beta. I call it quant active management.
Right.
But it's these formulaic ways of picking groups of stocks or bonds, mostly stocks. But to me, again, that's just active management, but it's considered passive because it is rather passively following a formula, but it's a formula that a person made up.
Right.
So yeah, all of that to me is active. There's very few, I mean, whether it just in a broader sense, whether I look at individuals who say, oh, I'm a do-it-yourself indexer, or the robo-advisors who are sort of building a brand on the coattails of indexing, very, very, very few are true to the traditional indexing, you know, like a John Bogle would advocate.
Yeah. So a couch potato portfolio in its strictest sense, I don't know if there are any robo-advisors that are mirroring that exactly. They all seem to have little tweaks with the products that they run. And I think there's various reasons for that. One is, maybe philosophically, if you have something that is just, say, a copy of, say, Dan Bortolotti's couch potato portfolios, mm-hmm. they're going to say, well, what's the real value of paying a layer fee when I can just sort of replicate it because Dan's giving you the recipe on his blog, right? So I think a lot of them will say, well, that's one possible reason why they would drift away from maybe a true couch potato type portfolio. And a second one is, it's really tough to make money as a robo-advisor because the margins are razor thin. I mean, even if you're adding in an advisory fee of 35 to 50 basis points, think of the scale that you would need because robo-advisor, I mean, okay, there are individual broker teams who have more in assets than the biggest robo-advisor in the US.
Absolutely.
Right? So this is an individual with their team of assistants and whatnot. So you've got one person making a fair bit of money. And they've got a team of, let's say it's 10 people. There are broker teams with over $10 billion in assets in the US and way more than that. In Canada, there are broker teams who have more assets than all the robo-advisors put together in Canada.
Yes.
But if you take all the robo-advisors put together in Canada, look at how many people they employ. That's a lot of salary. That's a lot of overhead. So they're going to need billions upon billions of assets just to even get to break even. So there's, of course, going to be pressure to get money from people somehow. And that would be A, the advisory fee, but maybe also looking at products that maybe have higher costs and what have you. So what are your thoughts on just the general nature of robo-advisors? I'm a fan of robo-advisory services. I think they fill a very important niche. They've been very disruptive and contributed to a decrease in costs for all investors, whether or not you use a robo-advisor. But there's a lot of arguments and debates about robo-advisors in light of a potential commission ban. And people are saying that if you get rid of commissions, you get rid of advice for the small guy. And some people say, well, that's perfect place for a robo-advisor to fill. What's your general take on the whole conversation about robo-advisors versus human advisors?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You hear a lot about supply chains these days, because if the past couple years have taught us anything, it's that an efficient, well-managed supply chain is absolutely critical to keeping businesses successful and consumers happy. I'm Will Haywood, and I host a podcast called All Business, No Boundaries, where we talk about supply chains, how they work, what happens when they don't, and the innovations that are redefining what's possible in the world of logistics. Join me for insightful interviews with thought leaders and industry experts. We discuss how optimizing supply chains can break down the barriers that are holding businesses back. That's All Business, No Boundaries by DHL Supply Chain. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Boy, yeah, and there's so many different angles with robo-advisors. I think that a lot of people, especially Canadians, I think in some ways we are different than Americans in this way. I think a lot of people like to speak with a person. And that is an option to an extent with a robo. You can pick up the phone, you can do a live chat. I think it's just a matter of creating an option that is really going to cater to people who want that kind of service. And I think that's fine. I think there's a place for it. Like you, I think what they're doing is kind of cool. And it will be needed with the direction that regulations are heading in. You know, whether it's a commission ban, imposing a best interest standard on advisors, one or both of those, either one of them is going to create a bit of an advice gap, you know, where certain people just lose access for practical purposes. I think there are going to be people who gravitate to one and those who gravitate to the other. And frankly, as much as there are people who like developing that relationship with an individual advisor, there are going to be people who say, oh, I don't want to sit in front of this advisor and listen to the same. I mean, they all sound the same, you know.
Yeah.
I could see that too. Mm-hmm. And so to be able to do it from the comfort of your home, not even getting off the couch, just with your mobile phone, I think is going to appeal to a lot of people.
You know, I've talked about this with other people before, but even getting a phone call, I absolutely detest speaking on the phone, right? And I think it's just a shift that that we're starting to see. And I think, you know, younger people especially, it's not even really a smartphone anymore. It's just a mobile computer. It happens to have a phone calling feature on it,
right,
which I think is rarely used. So that interface that people have with the financial services is changing. At the same time, I'm also finding, and I don't know if you've heard this too, but you know, there's younger investors may be more inclined to start with a robo-advisory service. Part of that reason might be the type of advisor that would deal with someone who doesn't have a lot of money. I think generally speaking, you can say that the level of quality isn't the same as the good advisors that do exist out there. So a lot of people tend to paint all advisors with the same brush, but we both know that there's a huge variance in the skill, the quality, experience of advisors, right?
Yes, huge.
And to a certain extent, you know, if a commission ban gets rid of the lower 25% of advisors, I don't know how anyone could say that that is a bad thing, because the standards to being in charge of someone's retirement savings are so ridiculously low in this country that you really don't have a leg to stand on.
I believe that finally is going to be changing. Like, I think the wheels that are in motion on that, I mean, part of it we're already seeing, right, with some of the added disclosure. But I think that's happening. And frankly, I don't know any advisor that's chasing a $1,000 or $5,000 account to start with, which is what the robos are really catering to and the gap that they're going to fill. The gap is already here.
Right.
It it's not, I mean, I think the gap would grow mm-hmm. with some of these other initiatives, but you know, small investors are already underserved. If you define it as people who are really receiving quality advice, just leave it as broad as that.
Right.
I don't know anybody with a few thousand dollars or even $25,000 who's really getting good advice.
That's a really good point, because a lot of people have positioned it, lobbyists have positioned it that you're going to create an advice gap if you eliminate commissions. But I think you're spot on that there already exists a pretty big advice gap for the smaller investor. Yeah, interesting point. Now, when it comes to the last thing I want to talk about with respect to robo-advisors, the business models in terms of how they charge fees. So really there's, as far as I know, one subscription-based service, Nestwell, so Randy Cass's shop, where they charge by the month. And then you've got the, I think everyone else charges a percentage of assets.
Yep.
Do you have a particular view on which model is better, or is it just a matter of some is one way is good for some and one is good for the other?
I think I probably emailed you initially, and it might have been after you had Randy Cass on mm-hmm. on your podcast, to say, I would have thought subscription-based is just not going to work. And it still may not. But as I thought about it a bit more, and he revealed, I think, a little information about the business here, the numbers started to make a little bit more sense. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to try to remember the exact numbers, but I think what it worked out to, whatever the pricing model is for Nest Wealth, it worked out to a pretty decent, what I think was a pretty decent percentage of assets for a typical account.
Right.
I think ultimately you have to have a good revenue base based on a percentage of assets. Mm-hmm. It's the way the industry is built. It's the way the regulatory system in a way it requires, like I when I went on my own, when I first went on my own back in 2003, one of the things I offered, it wasn't the sole focus, was just straight investment advice. I didn't handle any money. I didn't have discretion or even execute trades for anybody. Just pure advice, charge a fee for it. I was licensed, all above board.
How expensive was that?
Well, back then, well, expensive enough, but it wasn't what it would be today.
So it's more expensive today?
The regulatory environment has changed to the extent that some of the rules have changed to make that more difficult. But the enforcement of the rules has changed significantly, where it just wouldn't be feasible the way I was doing it. I think there is still a way if you wanted to build it like that from scratch. So what I did was I didn't charge a percentage fee. It was a straight hourly fee. I kind of played around with a flat sort of project type fee. Mm-hmm. The hourly worked better. But even then it just didn't work. It's a difficult model. And you know, people would say, well, lawyers and accountants, they basically, this is how they function. This is how they bill. It's different in that there isn't an inherent embedded need to go see an investment person, because the industry structured in a way to make it so easy to do it yourself.
Right.
In one form. And you never really know, like if you don't have the assets on your book, so to speak, if you don't have responsibility for the assets, there's not necessarily a requirement for people to come back in a year for their annual review. It was always encouraged, but they might do, in the best case, a year and a half, mm-hmm. maybe 2 or 3 years. I think I had somebody come back after 5 years, say, hey, can you refresh that for me? And so that makes it difficult to know, well, how many clients can you actually handle? If they're all coming back in 12 months, no problem, then you know the frequency. And maybe over time you can sort of get a feel for what that frequency works out to for your clients. But you'd never really know in the first probably couple of years, how many clients can I handle?
Right.
You bring on too many and they all come back every 12 months. Well, now you're scrambling and you get a... try to adjust just to keep up. If you try to spread it out a little bit more, then you don't have enough business, right? So they're coming less frequently than you expect. So anyway, probably more than people want to know about that model, because I just don't think it's sustainable.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, I've often looked at the paradox between financial advice in the accounting profession and in the financial advisor profession. You know, with accountants, it is, you know, hourly a project rate is normal. And if you went to people in that profession and say, hey, guess what, guys? Now you're going to be able to charge a percentage of someone's net worth or whatever. They'd be salivating, right? Yeah. You're jumping all over each other. It's just such a foreign concept. And yet from this industry, it's the exact opposite. And I would argue that there's a lot of value in good financial advice. Obviously, yes. If someone is just saying, all right, you know, fill out this 12 question risk profile questionnaire, and here's your portfolio that aligns with that. See you next year when you've got an RSP deposit. There's not a lot of value in that.
No.
So let's talk a little bit about cost and value. And cost is now going to be even more at the forefront. I mean, people who are in the industry and in the investor advocacy side have been hammering home about fees for a long time. But now investors who maybe weren't attuned to that conversation are going to start getting some new paperwork, which is part of phase 3 of CRM2. Very sexy name. This industry goes out of its way to confuse people and come up with new acronyms. So CRM2 stands for Client Relationship Model 2, and phase 3 kicked in July 15th, 2016. And there's basically two new reports that are required in phase 3. So walk us through what these two new reports are.
So one discloses your costs and expenses that are received by your dealer firm or your advisory firm for the year for the accounts that you have with them. So that includes things you pay them directly, like trustee fees for registered accounts, commissions for trading, for example. But it also includes payments from third parties that the dealer receives. So mutual fund commissions, any other product commissions that are embedded and that you don't pay directly.
Right. So what does show up on the indirect charges part would be things like trailing commissions.
Yep.
You'd also see deferred sales charges. Yep. Commissions would be there. But you wouldn't see the embedded management fee of managed funds, right?
Of any product with an embedded fee. So the biggest one that's always mentioned is mutual funds because the fees are higher, but it applies to ETFs, it applies to structured products because some of them have fees that are embedded that are pretty explicit. Mm-hmm. Anything with an embedded fee, closed-end funds is another one.
Right. So let's take a hypothetical example, just using numbers off the top of our head, because I didn't ask you to prepare anything, so I won't hold you to the penny or anything. But let's say a typical client, I think the number that's batted around is, you know, a $50,000 portfolio, something like that. So if we had the most typical client, most Canadians are probably owning mutual funds. And these funds for a $50,000 account are going to be in the range of what? 2 to 2.5%. Would that be fair?
It's fair, probably on the lower end on average, but yeah.
Let's say it's 2%.
Yeah.
So what would show up on this cost and compensation report?
So if we just focus on the product, it would be if in the past year there was a transaction that gave rise to commission. So a purchase where there was a front end load taken off. So that's a sales charge that comes right off the top of your investment. Or if you purchased a deferred sales charge fund, that commission, which is typically 4 or 5% of the amount you invest, that would show up on there. And they should be, I think they have separate line items for each of those. It wouldn't all just be lumped together as a fund commission. And you have the trailing commission. Mm-hmm. So those are the three possible items that would show up on your new report. It would be either front end or deferred sales charge. And then
the front end would show up under direct charge because you pay that directly off the top.
Yeah, you're right.
And indirect would be the deferred sales charge and the trailing commission.
Right.
So it's possible that, let's say someone came into $50,000, went to an advisor January 1st, or let's say the beginning of the reporting period, and they were sold a deferred sales charge mutual fund of all $50,000.
Yeah.
So they're going to see on this report, I guess, $2,500 show up on the indirect charges.
Yep.
And there's also going to be a year's worth of trailing commissions. And yes. Generally speaking, I mean, we're getting into the weeds here, but as someone has sold a deferred sales charge, generally speaking, the trailing commission is lower.
It would be half. So typically on a $50,000, your trailing commission line would be about $250,
right?
If I have that right.
Yeah.
It's a half of 1%.
Right.
Typical.
So just between those two alone, you're looking at $2,750 showing up on the statement. You might have a $100 account administration fee and so on and so forth. So for the average person who's just bought $50,000 of a mutual fund in a deferred sales charge option, imagine that is going to look like quite of a shock.
Yes, I think most $50,000 accounts without the deferred sales charge, the numbers are going to be very underwhelming. Mm-hmm. But with a DSC, that deferred charge, that big commission is going to jump off the page.
Right.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of an extreme example. But let's say that you've got someone who's got $50,000. And you mentioned that what's going to show up on this report might look somewhat underwhelming because now let's say there's no deferred sales charge. Let's say it's no load. So there's no commission paid up front to the financial institution or advisor, but they've held this $50,000 for the entire year and the MER is 2%. So they're going to see 1% as a trailing commission for that year.
Yeah.
So $500 would show up there. But they wouldn't see was the other 1% that the fund company retains.
Correct.
So they're not getting the whole story, are they?
No.
Okay.
No.
Now, I'm assuming that, whenever the regulators put out a request for comment, I know that you respond. And what are your general thoughts on what needs to occur in terms of this disclosure to clients? Is CRM2 phase 3, is that enough? Is that all we're going to see for the next little while? Because now we've placated investor advocates a little bit. Or do you see actual movement here? Because for me, I think that more people are going to get confused than ever before.
There's going to be a lot of confusion still. But I think it's still an important step forward. And my hope is that this is still evolving. Mm-hmm. Because there are a couple things, a couple of little nuances that I think people will appreciate. One is that the actual report is going to be broken up by account. So let's say you have $50,000, but it's broken up between your TFSA, your RRSP. Maybe you have a little non-registered account. Maybe you don't. Maybe you have a locked-in account from a previous job or whatever. Mm-hmm. But say potentially over a few different accounts. And that's just if you're single. If you're married and you have kids, you can, the accounts multiply. But the let's say even the $500 trailing commission, for example, if it's broken up across different accounts, it's going to look like, nickels and dimes.
Right.
So it's not going to have the big impact. And I wonder even the, I think the deferred sales commission still looks big regardless on an amount like that. But the other thing is that comparability is going to be an issue, even with the costs and charges report. So what if instead of the deferred sales charge happening in the past year, it happened before 2016? Mm-hmm. Before 2016, none of that stuff, I can see by your nodding, this doesn't end up on this report.
Yeah.
But your trailing commission, because of that big fat commission up front, is half of what it would be normally.
Right.
So you could have two accounts. They could be virtually identical with two different advisors. One is going to show half the cost of the other. And it's only because the one advisor sold you deferred sales charge before the disclosure window, and he's going to look a lot cheaper, and he's not, and he's actually made a lot more money
right
off of your account. So there's little things like that, and it would never be obvious unless you already know. And if you already know that level of detail,
yeah, you wouldn't have bought a DSC fund.
You could fill out the rest of the picture yourself.
Right. Yeah, so. Exactly. And that, kind of skipping ahead here, but that kind of always gets to the question. I think we've chatted about this before. One of the most asked questions I get is, how do I know I'm picking a good advisor? And I struggled to come up with an answer that I can stand behind and be confident that if I give them this, they'll be able to go out and find a good advisor. How tough is it to counsel someone who asked that question on how to answer that question?
It's tough. I think I have a somewhat better answer than I used to. because I'd kind of throw my arms up in the air and I'm like, I have no idea. Like, it's difficult. I think before you deal with somebody, you know, I think doing things like credentials and all that, I mean, that's all important. You want to know someone's qualifications. I think asking things like, can you show me a sample of what my reports will look like on an ongoing basis? Do you disclose, I mean, it's less of an issue now, but still is an issue. Do you disclose, is there somewhere where I'm going to see my costs, mm-hmm. total costs? Mm-hmm. Are you going to show me performance? Again, some of those things, that second report, which we haven't gotten around to yet, is personalized performance reporting.
Yeah.
So that's all coming around. But you can even ask things like, is there any form of benchmarking in my performance report? Because that's optional, not required mm-hmm. by the rules. So you want to look, ask for things like that so you can get a sense. So if you can actually see a sample, electronic or otherwise, but at least get a sense of, well, here's what I'm going to receive. I think that's one good step. You know, maybe the other questions still sort of get around to the standard things around who am I working with. I think a lot, though, is around setting expectations. You know, you might meet one person at the prospecting stage, but maybe you'll be dealing with somebody else on an ongoing right. basis. So you want to be clear about that. How often am I going to see you? Mm-hmm. How often are we going to meet? And does that include face-to-face, phone, email? I mean, I think a lot of people are maybe afraid or intimidated to ask all those things, but I think it's not, you have to find something that fits with what you want and need, right? Because some people, it's like, no, I don't need to meet with you that often. It's cool.
Right.
We can, you know, call me if there's something urgent, email me, but I don't need to come in and see you more than once a year. Mm-hmm. So part of it is just fit. It's not that you necessarily, maybe you don't need the highest level of service and maybe you don't have the assets to justify it. But I think the reporting, the benchmarking, the transparency, just being upfront with people. And the problem is it's a hard thing to judge ahead of time when you don't have the knowledge to start with.
Yeah. And that's kind of the thing that always I get hung up on.
Well, so then your friends and my friends, they just keep coming back to us and saying, hey, so I met with my advisor and here's what he said when I asked this question. And they're like, no. Or that's a great answer. You have a great advisor. So
yeah.
I don't know that there's a great, I'm coming back to, I don't know.
See, it's really tough, right?
It is a tough one.
Now, what we've talked about is really mostly on the investing side, reporting, benchmarking, and transparency. And using an overarching perspective, the one thing that I ask people to be on the lookout for is the level of candor. Because this business is a sales business, right? Whether you're fee for service, hourly, percentage of assets, commission, whatever, it's all a form of sales. And if you're going to be good at sales, you're going to be pretty slick, right?
Yes.
But being on the lookout for the level of candor, I think, is one thing that, you know, you don't usually see on checklists. Like, oh, do they have a CFP? Do they have all this stuff? But when you ask them things like, all right, so tell me, break down the costs on a sample report. And I always say, if you start to feel like there's a song and dance that's about to start, that's kind of a red flag. But if you got someone who's willing to give you the pros and cons of their model of compensation and is willing to openly talk about, here are the other options and here's why this one is good in these situations and why that one might be better, I think that's good.
Yeah.
But you have to take the time, you have to invest the time to research this. You can't just say, you know, let me do a quick Google search on a Saturday because I'm meeting with advisors on Monday and that's it. That's too little. But again, we've talked about the investing side, but what should people get from financial advice? It's not just investing anymore because to a certain extent, part of it is being automated. A lot of human advisors have their own processes, right? Which they basically dole out to everyone. It's basically the same, but it's tweaked towards their individual risk profile and goals and whatnot. So there's more to financial advice than just the investing side. So what should people be looking for when engaging the financial service? What kinds of advice should they be getting?
So there should be an effort on the advisor's part to spend the time to understand the purpose of, you know, like why you're sitting in front of them. And if they have money to invest, for example, what is the purpose of that money? Because everything should flow from that, right? I mean, clients aren't going to come in and say, well, I need 7.5% per year over the next 30 years. And, you know, they're going to come in and say, frankly, sometimes they don't really know what they want to want the money to accomplish or what they want us to help them do. Mm-hmm. So sometimes we need to have a discussion just to flesh that out a little bit. But usually people will come in with some description, some objective to say, oh, I want to retire at X, you know, whatever age. Or I want to donate X, you know, some amount to charity. And, you know, they'll come in with some broad description of what they want. It's our job, I think every advisor's job, to take that and work with the client to translate that into a measurable goal that you can, well, first of all, that you can quantify, that you can measure progress against, and frankly, benchmark on an ongoing basis, whether you're above or below target. I mean, the portfolio, I mean, we talk a lot, you hear a lot about outperforming the index and outperforming ETFs. That I wouldn't say that's not important. The first priority should be, let's make sure we achieve what it is you're trying to do with this money. Mm-hmm. That should be the primary benchmark. That should be the focus. How you do it is, you know, comes down to what investments you choose, what kind of investment exposure. But that really should be not just secondary. That's kind of the final end output. Mm-hmm. There's several steps that should come before that. And, you know, there's too much focus on that, you know, sort of fast forwarding to the product side. Cause it's, right. I was going to say it's exciting, but I guess for some, you know, for people it is. I mean, yeah. You sort of dig into the details and buying investments and you sort of feel good when you see it written up in a positive way.
And there's a lot of people who, you know, when they watch various business channels, they get excited about certain people's stock picks and rates of return and how did they do for the last 5 years. It's not as...
Where's your gong and your bell? Like, we need some...
Yeah. And you know, it's just not sexy to talk about, man, term 20 versus term 10. Yeah. Oh, man, just picking this and getting this decision right is just... That's not sexy, right? It's necessary.
It's necessary, but and it's not fun. And not only is it kind of boring, it could actually be somewhat invasive because it's a... Like if you're doing real financial planning, and it doesn't necessarily have to be super comprehensive where you're, you know, even looking at general insurance, like home insurance and stuff, can be, but doesn't have to be. But just that there is a philosophy of dealing with clients in a way that starts with, you know, trying to, with the purpose of achieving their goals. And if you have that, you're going to do some form of financial planning with them, whether it's focused on investments or retirement, or whether you're doing something more comprehensive. I think that, like when I look at, you know, not just what we do, but when I look at the advisors that I know, that I'm very comfortable recommending anybody to, that's what they do. They have a planning approach that they take, and it's because it makes sense. And you know, the challenge is they're dealing with higher net worth clients as we are. But I think that's the way the industry needs to go and figure out, and I think there is a way to do it, but to figure out an economical way, but to still treat people the way they need to be treated, where they should be, which is if you're going to give advice, it should be driven by some form of purpose or goal, mm-hmm. not do you need income, moderate growth or high growth.
Right.
So.
Yeah, because they're saying, moderate growth sounds good.
Yeah, right. I don't know. Let's pick the one in the middle.
Yeah. Right, yeah. Okay, so financial planning, goal setting, being able to measure progress against a goal. These are all things that investors should be looking at as opposed to focusing just on investing. Having said that, let's now turn back to the second report that people will be getting.
Yes.
Which is basically their personalized rate of return,
yep.
as opposed to the time-weighted rates of return that they'll see on, you know, a brochure for a mutual fund or whatnot. So do you want to break down what is meant by personalized rate of return?
Boy, this is going to be exciting in audio form. So so the regulators are requiring... well, actually, let me step back for a second. When you see rates of return for the TSX, for a mutual fund, let's say in an ad in the paper, that is what we call a time-weighted rate of return.
What's a newspaper?
Wait a minute. Am I that much older? No. So when you see that ad, you see, you know, something on the news with the stock indexes, it's time weighted, which means you could replicate that if you know, whatever period they're measuring. If you bought at the beginning, you held it to the end, let's say if it's a 3-year period, and you didn't do anything in between, you didn't add any money, you didn't take anything out. That's how you can replicate the time weighted rate of return. What regulators thought was best to put on these reports is something called a money-weighted or dollar-weighted rate of return. And the difference is it accounts for any flows, any money you add or take out in between those beginning and end points of the performance measurement period, the timing of them, and the size of the cash flows. Mm-hmm. And that's the, you because of that, you will always see different numbers between the two. And because of that, you will not be able to compare your number to what happened with the TSX or what that fund or what some other ETF performed over the past year or 3 years.
Right. So as an example, let's say you had an investment and for the first 11 months of the year, it had no return whatsoever. It was flat for the first 11 months, and then it made 10% in December. The time-weighted return would be 10% for the year.
Yeah.
If you put your money in say, a monthly form, January, February, whatnot, the January contribution had 11 months of no growth and 1 month of 10%. Yeah. But the November contribution had a 10% rate of return. So that money on an annualized basis, that November contribution had like 120% annualized return, and January had 10 or whatnot. So depending on cash flows, the rate of return that your money, your personal rate of return, is going to be different than this time-weighted return. That's essentially it, right?
Yes. Yeah. And you nailed it. It's because all of the money is not invested for that entire period. If you're continually adding or taking money out, some of that money is invested for a shorter period of time.
Right. So if the poor guy invested in January, took all his money out in November, his personalized rate of return would be zero.
Yeah. Right?
Okay. So there's a difference. And then this return is going to be reported on this new report, which will be now mandated for investors to receive. And is this, again, is this going to serve to confuse people?
I think it will.
Yeah.
And again, I think it's for two reasons. One is because conceptualizing a dollar-weighted return is a difficult thing.
It is tough. I have to sit down and think about, you know, when I'm explaining it to someone, I have to think, all right, hold on. And I'm someone who's been in the industry, and you're someone who's been in the industry for a long time, and you got to take a pause and make sure you're doing it right. And someone who is not that plugged in, this is going to be like, you know, looking at the Matrix, you know, and there's all these digits flowing across the screen. It's me like, what is this, right? You're telling me that this is my time-weighted return and it's different from my personalized rate of return. I don't get it. So it's a step in the right direction, but taken in isolation without someone there to explain it to you, it can be quite confusing.
It is. So it'll be confusing again because of of trying to grasp this idea of what does it mean? If I have a, you know, and because of the flows, you're sometimes going to have a poor looking return in an otherwise good year. And you're like, well, why did that happen? Well, it's because you added money after a run up and the rest of the year was kind of flat or down or whatever. So there's more explanation that's needed. But again, like the cost report, it's broken out by account.
Right.
There isn't an aggregated performance report for your household or for your total portfolio. That's one of the things that we provide to clients and we have for years. But that's going to be part of the confusing part because you'll have accounts all over the map. Because some of them might have different purposes. You know, education fund might be returning way differently than your retirement fund,
right,
especially if you're the beneficiary of that education account is 17, for example.
Right.
So it's a step in the right direction. And again, that's why I hope this is a, you know, beginning of an evolution. You know, it should have been done 20 years ago or more. But it's here. I don't want to complain too much about it, but I think there's more work to do. So I hope that this is, one step, a big step, but that there's at least one or two more to come.
And we've talked about this before. A lot of things that have been happening lately were first prescribed in 1995 by Gloria Ann Stromberg.
Yes.
So 22 years ago.
Yeah. And I think, and you saw this, I think on Twitter, I grabbed a screenshot of a paragraph from her report in 1995. And it could have been written today. And I purposely did that. I posted that right after the regulators put out their report saying, hey, listen, we did all this research. We are going to come up with a consultation paper proposing to end commissions.
Right.
And they had some explanations in there. And I thought, wait a minute. So I went back, and thank God for PDFs, so you can just do word searches. So then I found the paragraph. I took a screenshot, and it could have been easily written today as in 1995.
Right, right.
Yeah, it's sad, but we're getting there.
Yeah. Okay, so the last thing, because I don't want to take up too much of your time. The last thing I want to talk about is regulatory arbitrage. So now we're really inside baseball here. But what we just talked about, you know, it's pretty onerous for financial advisors in terms of this extra regulatory requirements, compliance requirements are getting more and more complex. And so there's this concept of what's known as regulatory arbitrage. And essentially, why don't you explain what it is?
So there are, you know, anybody calling themselves an advisor, they might be unlicensed. They might be licensed to sell insurance products only. They might be licensed to sell investment products, which sort of generalize, which kind of has two buckets underneath it. And then there are those that are just licensed to give advice, like ours. So regulatory arbitrage, you know, all of them but the insurance and the unlicensed part fall under securities regulation. So if securities regulators say, well, here we're going to make this change, now you have to disclose, you know, these things. People who are insurance only registered, doesn't affect them at all.
Right.
Now, a lot of the insurance licensed people in general have both licenses. So if you have a stockbroker, for example, as an advisor, likely either that person or someone in that branch has an insurance license as well. But where you have... And I've heard anecdotes of this, but I actually heard, you know, some confirmation of it as well from, you know, with actual someone at one of the regulatory bodies where a certain number of people will drop their securities regulated license, mutual funds, stock brokerage, whatever, and just keep their insurance only license. Mm-hmm. So now they can sell segregated funds, which really walk and sound and look like mutual funds. Mm-hmm. They can sell it on a deferred sales charge. They can receive trailers. They can, if they sell enough of it, they can qualify for a trip to Europe,
right,
or whatever. They have sales contests still in the insurance industry. They don't have to tell you any of it. Mm-hmm. They don't have to disclose any of the commissions. They don't have to tell you about the sales contest or the sweatshirt they got or the dinner they were just taken to. None of it.
Right. So it's possible that there are people saying, oh, there's this new regulatory reform coming out and I'm going to get a report this year that tells me all the costs that I'm paying. And if they are, you know, holding all segregated funds because maybe their advisor decided to take advantage of this regulatory arbitrage, they're not going to see any of that stuff. And they might be ignorant to the fact that they are actually paying a lot more than people who are regulated under, you know, securities administrators. So, and I can tell you personally, so I was a wholesaler for a time and I met with, principals of different investment dealers and they often had relationships with MGAs, which are for the life insurance licensing. And I had a couple of them say, yeah, we are dropping our either MFDA dealership or IROC dealership to switch strictly to being an MGA, because not only just avoiding, CRM2, this was years before this was enacted, just because of the compliance requirements were just so much more onerous. And so it's kind of scary to think that, you know, that kind of thing happens and there is such an uneven regulatory landscape. And don't even get me started with, you know, other types of investment pitches out there that aren't even held to those standards. I don't know if I should even mention them.
Well, you can't tease us, Pri.
I don't want to get sued. Oh, okay. So anyone who's will know what that means. I may even edit that out.
can you speak generically?
You know what? When I turn off the recording button, then I'll tell you. And if anyone wants to know, they'll have to buy me a coffee. But anyways, Dan, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to educate our listeners on the finer aspects of regulations, robo-advisors, and financial advice. And for all my guests, they have their opportunity to give a little commercial for themselves, their firm, or whatever they want to talk about. So if you want to tell us more about HighView, the typical client that might be serviced by a HighView Financial, take it away.
Well, yeah, I thank you. And it's been fun to be here in person and have this chat. But yeah, HighView is like, I'm just really proud to be associated with the firm and the people behind it. You know, I had options. I could have gone in many different directions, but, you know, we serve wealthy families and institutions, mostly foundations on the institutional side. And it really is driven by this goals-based approach that we do. So we serve clients with a hard minimum of $1 million and up. It's a very wide range. And we build purpose-driven, goals-based portfolios. We are very transparent. When clients ask us questions, we try to be really thoughtful about our responses. We're just really treating clients the way we would want to be treated if they were sitting across the table, you know, if we were sitting in their seat.
And do you have a fiduciary responsibility to your clients?
We are registered as portfolio managers, so we have discretion over assets, which means we basically control it and we can make changes without having to call everybody all the time for it. It's something that's agreed to and all disclosed beforehand. And so, yes, we are legal fiduciaries. We're legally held to that standard because we're actually controlling the assets of our clients. And so that automatically puts us in a position where we owe that higher standard of care to clients.
And for those who don't understand or may not know exactly what a fiduciary standard is, do you want to just explain what that is in layman's terms?
Yeah. So it's based on the idea that, you know, your client is a little bit more vulnerable because they're really relying on you. It's one thing when you have your typical advisor who is administering your account. If they want to make a change, if they want to rebalance, if, you know, they want to do something like that, they have to call you. You have to approve it. Mm-hmm. In our case, we just do it. And then we inform our clients of what we did and why we did it. We don't even have to do that, but we think that's only fair. We should do that so they understand what's happening. And so I'm probably going to mess up like the real formal definition, but the basic idea is because our clients are relying on us even more than most clients rely on their advisors, we're in a position of trust with respect to our dealings with them. And as a result, we're just going to be held to that higher standard. So we have to put their interests first. We have to not put our interests ahead of theirs in any way, shape, or form. So just even as an example, you know, we have some clients that are invested directly in stocks and bonds that are chosen by managers that we hire, outside managers. Mm-hmm. And what I do with my money is I invest it in the portfolios that all of our other clients are invested in. So I'm not buying stocks so that I don't have even the potential to be in a conflict position with any of our clients.
Right.
That's not a requirement. I don't have to have my assets invested alongside clients, but we just think it makes sense. And frankly, if we think we're doing such a great job in building portfolios, why wouldn't I want my money invested the same way? So that's the idea. It's kind of a rambling answer, but it's the idea that there's an extra reliance on us for our advice and that higher level of trust. So we're held to that higher higher standard.
Yeah, maybe on a future podcast, we'll dive into that side of regulation where we talk about, you know, the best interest standard that is being proposed and what implications that would have for the financial advice industry. But yeah, there's just so much to peel back about financial advice, the industry and regulation, and so many people are in the dark. So I really appreciate you coming in.
That's a pleasure.
And sharing your insights. And so where can people find you online if they want to get in touch with you?
They can find me on Twitter at Dan Hallett. I have
double L double T, right?
Double L double T, common mistake. and Highview Fin, like financial, highviewfin.com and danhallett.com.
Wonderful. Thank you very much for being on the show. And to my faithful listeners, if you enjoyed this episode or the podcast in general, don't forget to head over to iTunes to leave a rating. It literally takes a few seconds, but it means a lot for the podcast and helps me to secure great guests like Dan Hallett, double L, double T. That's it for today. We will see you next time.